people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others, I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press Weekly Newspaper, number 17, April 25th, 2011. AFP crashes globalist confab. Mainstream media totally ignores landmark conference in New Hampshire by Mark Anderson. When this American Free Press writer, accompanied by photographer Stephen Lombardo, finally reached the sleepy enclave of Bretton Woods in northern New Hampshire on Sunday, April 10th, there was no immediate outward sign that top bankers, former federal officials, former foreign officials, academics, and select journalists were holed up in the historic Mount Washington Hotel to monkey with the world's financial machinery. There were no television news crews camped along the long drive off Highway 302 to give viewers a glimpse of this meeting known as Bretton Woods 2. Neither the Boston Globe nor the New York Times carried anything prominent in their pages during the April 8 to 11 conference. Ditto for the Wall Street Journal, and their websites showed nothing as of April 11th. But the first Bretton Woods conference in 1944 gave the world nothing less than the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So a second Bretton Woods conference should have made huge waves. The world is going through the most serious financial convulsions in modern history, yet this 2011 meeting was all but ignored. In contrast, the 1944 meeting was heavily covered by the press. Near the hotel around 1 p.m., the only evidence that something unusual was afoot, besides polished black sedans that later appeared, were small signs scattered around that stated things like, "Soros, enemy of U.S., and Soros, take a hike," referring to internationalist billionaire George Soros, whose Institute for New Economic Thinking, INET, was endowed with $50 million and put on the second-ever Bretton Woods conference. The sign man, Cliff, spent several hours calling attention to the global-scale scheming happening inside the hotel. Another protester, Joe Barton, told AFP that his sign on state property, not hotel land, 100 feet from the security detail, was taken by hotel security and never returned. The local police chief, Barton alleged, drew his nightstick and heatedly warned Barton to stay away. One could argue that a private organization like INET ought to be able to rent an entire hotel and discuss whatever they want. But the identity and affiliations of the participants strongly suggest that today's recommendations could well become tomorrow's legislation. When private talks lead to public decisions, playing the private card does not hold water. Local residents and visitors hesitated to comment when informed of the conference, but Mark Catalano knew the conference's basic nature and plans to distribute AFP on a regular basis at his Twin Mountain Trading Post and at Living Water Campground. Several hotel staffers, with their jobs on the line if they talked too much, said conference participants would take a break, say little among themselves, and return to another session with the doors barred. Staffers had to immediately leave the conference area after they served the esteemed guests so the staff would not hear anything. Obviously, attendees did not want to be filmed or interviewed under any circumstances by media beyond their control. Page 2, personal from the editor. What a weekend. The weekend of April 8th through April 11th likely was my busiest ever as a reporter, and it was quite busy for the whole American Free Press staff. That weekend, AFP's Steve Lombardo and I dashed off on short notice to cover the Bretton Woods 2 conference in New Hampshire, right as AFP's tribute to Jim Tucker concluded in Washington and Jim left to cover the Trilateral Commission meeting. Thanks to all who attended the tribute, your participation is appreciated. And congratulations to Jim for his half-century of fine reporting and for taking the inevitable joke, since a roast was part of the tribute. Jim was not mercilessly barbecued like Frank Sinatra was by master roaster Don Rickles in the good old days, but it was fun. True to form, Jim kept working that day, departing the April 9th tribute around 5 p.m. because there were trilats to hunt. As for the Bretton Woods jaunt, driving a rental car in Boston traffic, dreadfully behind on sleep, was a dicey experience, having come off a bumpy bus ride, 4.0 on the Richter scale, for 7 hours from D.C. to Boston before darting north. But it was worth it to observe the surroundings and pry loose whatever information was available from the shady, Soros-inspired Bretton Woods meeting, despite the obstacles the event's sponsors erected. Turn to the Tucker tribute coverage starting on page 12 and see Jim's Trilateral Commission coverage on page 13. Also see page 1 for my account of the Bretton Woods visit and go to pages 10 to 11 for a more in-depth look at the content of that globalist event. There will be more news on Bretton Woods soon, even as the Bilderberg meeting approaches in June. I cannot help but mention that on April 8th, I ran into CBS Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer at the Dallas airport en route to Washington. He was friendly, and when I asked what was on his show April 10th, he said something about the government shutdown and the budget. He wasn't totally sure what his show would cover that Sunday, so I gave him a note that the Bretton Woods 2 conference was happening. He replied, "Yeah, I heard about that." "Well, Bob, let's see a news story soon. It would not hurt for AFP readers to call CBS and other networks and demand coverage of the Trilateral Commission, Bretton Woods 2, and the Bilderberg meetings. You need not necessarily say, 'American Free Press says so,' but these networks need some serious heat from the public." Mark Anderson, roving editor. News you may have missed. People's Budget offered as alternative. The organization Truth Out reports that Barack Obama, without staking out a firm position on the new federal budget, will find that convincing the powerful plutocrats in Congress to raise taxes on their wealthy sponsors will be next to impossible, in the words of an online Truth Out news bulletin. By compromising at the start, the president will end up with a plan that's even more destructive than his initial offer. However, the People's Budget, crafted by the Progressive Caucus, would curtail outrageous war spending, invest in jobless Americans by creating infrastructure projects, strengthen Social Security, etc. Cruel and unusual. About 250 of America's top legal scholars recently released a public letter saying that the military's treatment of WikiLeaks whistleblower Bradley Manning constitutes degrading and inhumane conditions, should be considered illegal and unconstitutional, and can even amount to torture. Considering the treatment Manning is receiving, that seems obvious. National Strike's Birthday. Tired of being robbed by the banksters and taxed unlawfully without real representation? We are told to tighten our belts so that we can repay the bankers. We are being dragged into more wars. Environmental agencies are raising the safe radiation limit so that they can fool us into believing we are safe from harm. So states Karen Quinn Tostado, an activist who started what's called the National Strike 1 year ago. Go to UnitedWeStrike.com online to hear the recent April 15th to 17th radio marathon, featuring several prominent and respected journalists and commentators seeking solutions to the money tyranny and the corruption it spawns. Land of the free? Dr. Todd and Selena Drexel have come forward as the parents of a 6-year-old girl who was recently forced to endure an enhanced pat-down, a euphemism for the groping public travelers now have to suffer at the hands of airport security. The story hit national news after the parents posted the video on the internet in order to highlight the humiliation travelers must now tolerate. State banks. The biggest banks in the world, including Bank of America and Citigroup, are nothing more than government-sponsored institutions and, as a consequence, should face stiff regulations, said Thomas Honig, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, during a speech at the National Association of Attorneys General 2011 conference. "That's what they are," he said. "You're a public utility, for crying out loud." Hot water? KHOU-TV in Houston has done an explosive series on radiation levels in drinking water. Hundreds of water providers around the Gulf Coast of Texas are providing their customers with drinking water that contains radioactive contaminants that raise health risks, according to state lab results and public health scientists, reported the online Texas Observer. The series examined thousands of state laboratory tests from water providers across Texas. It is yet to be determined if the radiation levels are a danger. Good news about solar power. General Electric wants to invest $600 million to build a new solar panel manufacturing plant in the United States. The plant will employ at least 400 people and produce enough panels annually to generate power for 80,000 U.S. homes, or about 400 megawatts. And that is good news. NWO's cure for nationalism? Do reports about the Federal Reserve handing out free money to bankers make your blood boil? Do you believe immigration in the United States should be curtailed? Don't worry, says a new report by the UK's Guardian newspaper. Scientists are hard at work developing a new category of pharmaceuticals that will shape a person's morality. It sounds like something out of fantasy books like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, but it is absolutely true. A pill to enhance moral behavior, a treatment for racist thoughts, a therapy to increase your empathy for people in other countries. These may sound like the stuff of science fiction, but with medicine moving closer to altering our moral state, society should be preparing for the consequences, reports The Guardian. Page 3. High-level crime and conspiracy. Short life expectancy for BP whistleblowers? By Pat Shannon. The investigation, if it can properly be called so, of the unsolved murder of the former high-ranking Pentagon official and presidential adviser John P. Wheeler III, who was also an expert on chemical and biological weapons, may be taking a turn in the direction of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Wheeler, 67, a West Point grad, was beaten and thrown into a garbage dumpster. His body was discovered in a Wilmington, Delaware landfill last New Year's weekend. Both police detectives and news commentators described it as an apparent hit, but little else was ever learned and no suspects have surfaced. There was great speculation by many at the time that Wheeler had begun to blow the whistle on the mysterious bird and fish deaths in Arkansas and Texas, and was about to expose the facts tying this to the chemtrails seen in our skies over the past decade. Now the speculation may be reverting to British Petroleum and the Gulf spill because a number of other BP whistleblowing scientists before and since the Wheeler murder have also died mysteriously, been jailed on questionable charges, or disappeared without a trace. Matthew Simmons, 67, a former energy advisor to President George W. Bush and admired among survivalist groups for his dire warnings on the upcoming commodity and fuel shortages about to hit this nation, died in his hot tub in Maine last August. Simmons had been gaining popularity as a whistleblower for blaming BP for its covered-up responsibility in defacing and vandalizing the Gulf of Mexico while hiding the truth from the general public. Only 4 days later, Ted Stevens, the 87-year-old defrocked senator from Alaska, said to have received communications regarding BP's faulty blowout preventer, perished in a plane crash. British Petroleum had donated $1 million to the University of Alaska to catalog the papers from Stevens' long political career. Roger Gruters began a cross-country bike ride in Oceanside, California on September 10th to draw attention to the Gulf Coast oil disaster. On October 6th, in front of the horrified eyes of his wife, who was trailing in a support vehicle, Gruters was struck by a truck and killed instantly in Panama City, Florida. Only a month later, Dr. Jeffrey Gardner of Lakeland, Florida, disappeared. He was investigating the unexplained bird deaths near Sarasota that are suspected to have been caused by the BP oil disaster. No one has heard from or spoken with him since. On November 15th, Chitra Chanhan was found dead of cyanide poisoning in a Temple Terrace, Florida hotel. It was officially ruled a suicide. She worked in the Center for Biological Defense and Global Health Infectious Disease Research and left behind a husband and 5-year-old child. The following week, James Patrick Black, director of operations for BP's restoration organization for the oil spill, died near Destin, Florida, in a small plane crash. Dr. Thomas B. Manton was one of the first to warn the public that far more oil than what BP had reported was gushing into the Gulf every day, and that the massive toxic oil and chemical plumes would travel up the eastern seaboard, contaminating beaches and wildlife all the way. Once the winds change, it will come eastward and pollute the beaches off the west coast of Florida, and the loop current could carry this oil spill right around Florida, through the Florida Keys, and pollute the east coast of Florida as well, Manton wrote on May 28, 2010. Dr. Tom Termato, national coordinator of the Gulf Oil Spill Remediation Conference, says Manton was murdered in prison. Manton had been sentenced to 15 years last August on a phony child pornography charge. Termato and others say evidence was planted on his computer. It is not known whether or not Anthony Nicholas Tremonti, 31, posed any threat to BP, but he too was arrested in January and charged with one count of possession of child pornography. Was this charge also faked? As an officer with the Mississippi Department of Marine Resources on the Gulf Coast, he may have known enough to qualify him for membership in this exclusive series of coincidences. He faces up to 40 years in prison if convicted. Page 4, AFP on the Military Establishment. Shadowy Group Employed to Predict Future by Keith Johnson. A shadowy group with ties to U.S. defense and intelligence agencies is seeking thousands of Americans to participate in a multi-year study at taxpayers' expense that will be tasked with trying to predict the future. Sponsored by the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA, a division of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the Forecasting World Events Project plans to assemble 5 competing panels whose members will make predictions about future events and global trends. According to the project's website, their objective is to investigate the accuracy of individual and group predictions that could lead to fundamental advances in the science of forecasting. This is the latest in a series of off-the-wall experiments IARPA has launched since its creation in 2007. The cost to taxpayers remains unknown at this time as the program is classified, but it is not hard to speculate that it will cost the United States tens of millions of dollars at least before it is shut down. IARPA is the intelligence community's version of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, a Pentagon undertaking responsible for introducing an Orwellian domestic spying program known as Total Information Awareness, TIA. This program was a massive data mining operation that utilizes ultra-large-scale computers to track the movements of millions of American citizens in an attempt to identify patterns consistent with alleged terrorist activity. In 2003, DARPA proposed its own forecasting project called the Policy Analysis Market for Terrorism. The plan was to establish an online trading venue whereby investors could speculate on future political and economic turmoil in the Middle East, such as coups, assassinations, and terrorist attacks. The organization that has been awarded taxpayer dollars to conduct IARPA's forecasting project is MITRE, a Maryland-based not-for-profit mercenary firm whose board chairman is former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger. Schlesinger is a notorious fearmonger and advocate for the war on terror, whose hawkish ideology can be summed up in his 1997 address to the Council on Foreign Relations regarding the CIA's future. Today, the intelligence community is under assault, partly because of a natural complacency after the end of the Cold War, in which the American people believe that we in this country are under threatened, opined Schlesinger. During his tenure as Defense Secretary under Gerald Ford, Schlesinger insisted on higher war budgets and no compromise negotiations with the Soviets. His harsh criticism of certain dovish congressional members ultimately led to his dismissal. Schlesinger's not-for-profit outfit came under public scrutiny in September 2004 when former DARPA employee Indira Singh testified before the 9/11 Commission and identified MITRE as one of two technology contractors that had unique access to systems capable of disabling NORAD and disrupting American air defenses during September 11, 2001. P-TECH, it's a software company, was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11, Singh said. Their specific job is to look at inoperability issues the FAA had with NORAD and the Air Force in the case of an emergency. If anyone was in a position to know the FAA, that there was a window of opportunity to insert software or to change anything, it would have been P-TECH along with MITRE. MITRE is also the last place of employment for John P. Wheeler III, a former CFR member and aide to Ronald Reagan. Wheeler's dead body was found in a Delaware landfill earlier this year. Less than a week before his death, Wheeler emailed a close friend expressing concern that the United States wasn't sufficiently prepared for cyber warfare, suggesting he was involved in one of MITRE's many cyber intelligence projects. To gain insight into what MITRE may be trying to accomplish with its forecasting project, AFP consulted Philip Giraldi, a former CIA station chief who now serves as executive director of the Council for the National Interest. He is also a respected columnist and television commentator whose works regularly appear on news websites, among other places. The U.S. government is fixated with matrixing and mathematical analysis, said Giraldi. What they're trying to do is get a broad database with as many inputs as they can. The theory here is that the unlettered and the unschooled and the unsophisticated, if you take a great mass of them and pool their perceptions, you will find that their perceptions can be of value. But overall, Giraldi doesn't see much promise in the project. Giraldi said that most in the intelligence community roll their eyes in regard to such programs. When I served in the agency, we referred to it as the flavor of the week, he said. Every so often, someone would come up with an idea, and if they were high enough in the food chain, that idea would become manifest. Whenever that happened, you just dealt with it until somebody realized the idea was stupid. Page 6. AFP on the potential candidates. Hoot Smalley, FDR, Israel, and Michelle Bachmann, by Michael Collins Piper. Americans who are fed up with what many perceive to be President Barack Obama's intransigence toward Israel will find a refreshing alternative in 2012 if Representative Michelle Bachmann, Republican Minnesota, manages to capture the Republican Party's presidential nomination. The attractive, outspoken congresswoman, founder of the Tea Party Caucus in the House of Representatives, is an aggressive, no-holds-barred supporter of the Zionist nation. She has taken Obama to task, asserting that the Obama administration has decided to leave Israel to face the world alone, effectively abandoning our longtime friend and ally when they need us the most. Ms. Bachmann told one interviewer of her special passion for Israel. I have been a longtime supporter of Israel. The first time I went to Israel was the day I graduated from high school. I spent a summer working on Kibbutz Biri near Beersheba in 1974. I've been 4 times to Israel, 3 times as a member of Congress. I loved Israel from the moment I first landed. I am honored to be in a position where I can help Israel. I have a tremendous love for Israel and great admiration for the Israeli people. Now serving in only her third term in the House of Representatives, first elected in 2006 following three terms in the Minnesota State Senate, the 55-year-old congresswoman has skyrocketed quickly to national fame and is much talked about in the mainstream media. Even the liberal New Republic magazine has acknowledged that Mrs. Bachman is a serious contender for the GOP presidential nod. Already in an early straw poll in New Hampshire, Mrs. Bachman ran fifth in a field of 20 names, outpolling former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. In private life, Mrs. Bachman and her husband Marcus have five children, have been foster parents to 23 others, and are the owners of a Christian counseling clinic. Mrs. Bachman is generally identified as a Christian conservative and associated in particular with hardline dispensationalists Tim and Beverly LaHaye, who look forward to Armageddon and who are said to have inspired Mrs. Bachman's political activism. Having studied advanced tax law, Mrs. Bachman served from 1988 to 93 as a U.S. Treasury Department attorney in the U.S. Federal Tax Court in St. Paul, where, by her own admission, she prosecuted and sought to send to jail hundreds of people charged with underpaying or failing to pay their taxes. Now ensconced on Capitol Hill, where she founded the Tea Party Caucus in the House of Representatives, Mrs. Bachman has become a major media figure and political power player. Unlike a lot of politicians who proclaim their support for Israel as a way to pander to the owners of the big media and to wealthy pro-Israel campaign contributors, who bankroll an estimated 70-80% of the national finances of both major parties, Mrs. Bachman has a real and passionate devotion to Israel. A member of a fundamentalist offshoot of the traditional Lutheran Church, Mrs. Bachman has said, "I am a Christian, but I consider my heritage Jewish because it is the foundation, the roots of my faith as a Christian." So her support for Israel is philosophically based and not just political rhetoric. Speaking before the Republican Jewish Coalition, Mrs. Bachman described her views. "We have to show that we are inextricably entwined, that as a nation we have been blessed because of our relationship with Israel, and if we reject Israel, then there is a curse that comes into play. My husband and I are both Christians, and we believe very strongly the verse from Genesis 12:3. We believe very strongly that nations also receive blessings as they bless Israel. It is a strong and beautiful principle." Mrs. Bachman and other friends of Israel on Capitol Hill even introduced a resolution in the House, backed by nearly half of the members of the Tea Party Caucus, urging Israel to use all means necessary to confront and eliminate nuclear threats posed by the Islamic Republic of Iran, including the use of military force. In that regard, although Mrs. Bachman has said that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced his intention to bomb the state of Israel, she was mistaken. He never made such a threat. Like all people, Mrs. Bachman makes errors, and this was one of a number of her gaffes, which have made her all the more down-to-earth and endearing to her supporters. For example, Mrs. Bachman referred to the Smoot-Hawley Act, which instituted much-needed protective tariffs supported by American nationalists, as Hoot-Smalley, generating much laughter. Mrs. Bachman also claimed the law was brought into being by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, when in fact it was the work of two Republicans, Senator Reed Smoot, Utah, and Representative William Hawley, Oregon, and signed into law in 1930 under GOP President Herbert Hoover. What concerns purists who expect public officials to know the issues is that Mrs. Bachman falsely claimed tariffs made the nation's already precarious economy worse. A variety of historians have exploded that myth put forth by internationalist free traders. Mrs. Bachman also puzzled serious readers when she made the strange claim she stopped being a Democrat and turned Republican when she read a book by novelist Gore Vidal that she felt made light of America's founding fathers. Anyone who knows anything about Vidal's novels about American history knows Vidal celebrates rather than demeans America's founders. Mrs. Bachman's bias against Vidal may also arise from the fact that Vidal has been a vocal critic of Israel and its lobby in America, and has also questioned the U.S. government's official version of the Oklahoma City bombing. In addition, Vidal's novels paint the America First non-interventionist movement in a positive light, in stark contrast to Mrs. Bachman's internationalist views. Mrs. Bachman's views on religion have also raised eyebrows, including her possible hostility to Roman Catholicism. Mrs. Bachman's church is affiliated with the small Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod, Wells, which states clearly on its website that it believes the papacy is the Antichrist. When confronted, Mrs. Bachman insisted it was absolutely false that Wells considers the papacy to be the Antichrist. Perhaps Mrs. Bachman had not read the website. Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. The gorilla on the ceiling? Keep your eye on the next federal crisis, the debt ceiling. Wall Street is nervous as a porcupine in a balloon factory that the heated debate over the budget, which nearly forced a government shutdown in mid-April, will spread to discussions on whether to raise the debt ceiling, the legal amount set by Congress that the U.S. Treasury can borrow from international bankers in foreign countries. As AFP goes to press on April 14th, the national debt stands at $14.28 trillion. That is just barely under the current debt ceiling, which is $14.3 trillion. By all accounts, the Treasury Department expects the federal government to hit its limit in the middle of May. Using accounting gimmicks, the government could limp on for several more months beyond that, but analysts say by the end of July, Washington would likely run out of money. That will put Congress on the hot seat in the coming weeks as legislators who rode the wave of Tea Party support to Washington continue to put pressure on the establishment and their party leaders to cut the budget or shut the government down. Fresh off their recent win, forcing Democrats to accept billions in spending cuts, fiscal conservatives want Washington to continue cutting before they agree to even discuss raising the amount the federal government will be allowed to borrow. So far, Republican leaders appear to be on board. I think that not raising the debt limit would have serious implications for the worldwide economy and jobs here in America, said House Speaker John Boehner, Republican, Ohio. But having said that, we're just not going to do the typical Washington thing, roll over, increase the debt limit without addressing the underlying problems. According to one report from a Washington Daily, Wall Street executives are already gearing up to make sure the interest payments keep rolling in for them. It is unclear how Wall Street will react if the government does decide to snub its debt. Financial firms could certainly play games with the fragile U.S. economy, driving up commodity prices such as oil even more, which will result in higher gas and food prices. They could also pull trillions of dollars out of the stock market, forcing a steep crash. Top banker Jamie Dimon, the head of JPMorgan Chase, said he expects bond traders to start dumping Treasury securities if they even get a whiff that the government could default on the debt. This would spell certain disaster for bond markets as investors make a mad rush for the exit sign all at once. Companies like us, every single company with treasuries, every insurance fund, every requirement, it will start snowballing, Dimon told reporters in late March. All short-term financing would disappear. The Bipartisan Policy Center, a nonprofit think tank, interviewed executives at some of the top Wall Street firms. Overwhelmingly, they were preparing to force Congress's hand into supporting raising the debt ceiling so they can continue to reap the benefits of massive interest payments on U.S. debt. They said that Congress better not think they can play the same shenanigans with the debt ceiling, Stephen Bell of the Bipartisan Policy Center told The Hill, a Capitol Hill daily. Most Americans remember how crybabies in the financial markets sobbed and whined when Congress failed the first time on September 29, 2008, to bail them out with taxpayer dollars. Wall Street played hardball by driving down the markets, taking many savings and retirement funds with them. After that, Congress quickly moved to pass, and the president eventually signed the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008 in early October 2008. That included the controversial $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, which had the Treasury buying up billions of dollars worth of worthless mortgage securities to take them off the bankers' books so they wouldn't have to deal with them. It is unknown how much money taxpayers lost by bailing out Wall Street in the past 3 years, but estimates put it in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Obviously, the best solution for America is for Washington to simply repudiate the national debt that has been accumulated by previous administrations over the years. Wall Street would likely come crashing down, but as far as Main Street is concerned, it cannot get any worse for the millions of Americans who have already lost their homes or cannot find decent-paying jobs because they have all been outsourced to third-world countries. Historic budget cuts still not enough. On April 8th, Republican and Democratic legislators managed to avoid an immediate budget crisis for the short term, but Congress still has to fund the government for the rest of 2011 and then start all over again negotiating for the fiscal year 2012 budget. Early reports indicate upcoming budget battles will be as contentious as ever. The House Appropriations Committee released its final budget for 2011 over the weekend of April 9th. According to a press release, the appropriations legislation contains historic spending cuts of nearly $40 billion and will provide funding to keep the federal government operating for the remainder of the fiscal year. If this bill passes, the final total for the year will bring the budget up to $3.75 trillion. That is reportedly $78.5 billion less than what Obama asked for earlier in the year, and a $39.9 billion decrease from the budget for 2010. My committee went line by line through agency budgets this weekend to negotiate and craft deep but responsible reductions in virtually all areas of government, said Representative Hal Rogers, Republican Kentucky, the House Appropriations Chairman. Our bill targets wasteful and duplicative spending, makes strides to rein in out-of-control federal bureaucracies, and will help bring our nation one step closer to eliminating our job-crushing level of debt. For Washington, this should be considered a success if it passes both the House and the Senate. And while it still does not pay down the national debt, cutting big government is always a step in the right direction. Never before has any Congress made dramatic cuts such as those that are in this final legislation, said Rogers. The near $40 billion reduction in non-defense spending is nearly five times larger than any other cut in history, and is the result of this new Republican majority's commitment to bring about real change in the way Washington spends the people's money. Proposed spending cuts. The following are just some of the proposed cuts Republicans are advancing in the final budget bill for fiscal year 2011. Various Commerce Department programs, $6.2 billion. Contributions to the UN and other international institutions, $377 million. The Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, $504 million. Foreign Food Assistance, $194 million. Assistance to State and Local Law Enforcement, $415 million. Environmental Protection Agency, $1.6 billion. Various Homeland Security Department programs, $226 million. FEMA First Responder Grants, $786 million. Community Health Care Centers, $600 million. HIV/AIDS and Other Disease Prevention Funds, $1 billion. Community-Oriented Policing Services Program, $296 million. Low-income heating assistance, $390 million. Community development funds, which help the poor buy homes, $942 million. Federal highway investment, $650 million. Page 10, Across the Nation with Mark Anderson. Bretton Woods 2, Big Names Attend Confab by Mark Anderson. The only mainstream newspaper known to have published a timely piece of any substance on the Bretton Woods II conference, the New Hampshire Times-Union, which does not reach a national audience, was permitted entry April 9th for a canned press conference and portrayed the event's head honcho, George Soros, as a harmless philanthropist. Anyone looking for evidence at the sessions that Soros, who is best known for giving money to liberal causes, was using the conference to take over the financial world and shape it to his own design would be sorely disappointed, Times-Union correspondent Sarah Young Knox wrote. Many of the panelists were university professors and as such focus on research and publishing, not politics. But insider billionaire Soros, as AFP reported last week, is much more than a maverick investor and Democratic Party donor. And as the front page story in this edition explains, the thin glaze of benign intentions and shop talk among intellectuals presented in the Time Union's news story belied the reality outside the sealed-off hotel where curious citizens and independent non-established media were treated as interlopers. The 2011 conference, Crisis and Renewal, International Political Economy at the Crossroads, was billed as a means of addressing the aftershocks of our global financial crisis, according to a posting on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, INET, which sponsored the event. INET's posting added, "We face our own challenge of reconstruction. The 1944 conference was, famously, largely an Anglo-American affair, whereas today's reconstruction must engage the larger European Union, as well as the emerging economies of Eastern Europe, Latin America, and Asia." So INET's stated goal of reconstruction, a revealing word used twice referring to vast regions of the world, is presented as no big deal since this event was supposedly about research and publishing, according to what the Times Union conveyed. But it's clear from INET's own words that this conference was designed to deal with the big picture. As AFP went to press, INET had posted videos of some panel discussions on its website just after the conference. AFP will review them for future stories. Logically, recommendations from a conference like this will function as soft law and influence legislation or executive policy decisions down the road, just as UN confabs eventually inspire binding agreements. The distinction between private and public is so minor these days as to be almost non-existent. A private, for-profit central banking system controls the money and credit of the world's nation-states and hammers them with interest charges for creating money. Governments essentially buy money from the banks, which has been the case for nearly 100 years in the U.S. and much longer abroad. So there is no historical basis to assume INET's Bretton Woods event can be regarded as a harmless gathering of intellectuals who just wanted to hear themselves talk. Notably, INET Executive Director Robert A. Johnson has credentials that reveal a background involving decision-making in government and in the business sector. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, Johnson was a managing director at Soros Fund Management, where he managed a global currency, bond, and equity portfolio, specializing in emerging markets. Prior to working at Soros Fund Management, he was a managing director of Bankers Trust Company, managing a global currency fund. Johnson served as chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee under the leadership of Chairman William Proxmire, Democrat, Wisconsin, states an INET biography. The New Yorker magazine's John Cassidy, listed as a participant by iNet, saw the Bretton Woods event as largely an intellectual aerobics session on economics, as related in his blog column dated April 12th. AFP, in trying to gain access like any other media, made several phone calls to iNet's listed media representative. No calls were returned. A call placed to the head of security of the conference site, the Mount Washington Hotel, also was not returned. The intent was to reach a conference spokesman. The other select media allowed inside included Alan Murray of the Wall Street Journal, Chrystia Freeland of Reuters, and three Financial Times writers, among others. At the April 9th press conference, according to the Times Union, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown remarked about investing in science and education, and added that America and Europe need to focus on high-value products that are based on science and education. He added that China should open up its consumer market to the Western world's products. Brown neglected to note that for the last 20 years or more, the U.S. was forced to throw its markets wide open to a barrage of Chinese imports, which have drastically undercut U.S. industrial might because the domestic barriers that stifle U.S. productivity, all the regulations, environmental edicts, taxes, usury on loans, and other factors, drive up the costs of U.S. goods and services as wages fall. Meanwhile, U.S.-based companies farm out their labor to lands such as China, where domestic costs are lower. The resulting products are shipped to the U.S. nearly tariff-free. Cash-strapped American consumers usually succumb to the cheaper imports and leave U.S. products on the shelves. This unravels the U.S. industrial base that used to support a thriving middle class. But to reverse this bind would mean adopting a nationalistic policy, which evidently is not on the iNet agenda. Brown predictably preached, "We can't retreat into nationalism." Globally-minded figures such as Brown always automatically condemn the concept of national self-interest, since they are instinctively afraid of national sovereignty in the financial realm, just as they bemoan it in terms of foreign policy. In their view, NATO calling the shots militarily equates with the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, both created at the first Bretton Woods confab in 1944, playing a major role in financially steering the nation-states toward a one-world system. Some 200 participants were at Bretton Woods II, which was iNet's second conference since its 2009 formation. A list of 94 confirmed speakers was released by iNet. Soros, who put on the event moderated by Mr. Johnson, also is associated with the Bretton Woods Committee, which promotes understanding of the IMF and the World Bank. A major participant at the first Bretton Woods conference in 1944, British economist John Maynard Keynes had talked about a world currency, the Bancor, but the measure was considered too radical then. A 35-page study was released 1 year ago that revived the Bancor concept. It's too soon to tell whether iNet's meeting in New Hampshire considered a global currency as an assumed cure for the world's economic ills, but the worldview of the leading figures who attended and the history of high finance point to more consolidation of the private monetary control already wielded against the world. Page 12, a tribute to Jim Tucker. Enthusiastic crowd gathers in Washington, D.C. to honor Jim Tucker's cutting-edge journalism, by Victor Thorne. An enthusiastic crowd gathered on April 9th at Washington, D.C.'s Capitol Skyline Hotel to laugh, applaud, and be entertained by an array of stories at AFP's tribute roast to honor longtime Bilderberg Group hound Jim Tucker. With Liberty Lobby founder Willis Cardo serving as the master of ceremonies, the event began with Michael Collins Piper commemorating AFP's legendary Old Grandad with, indeed, a bottle of Old Grandad whiskey. Piper then recounted some hilarious true tales, as he called them, about the olden days when he and Tucker resided in the same apartment building. To recognize the guest of honor's stellar career, Piper told those in attendance, "Jim Tucker's work in covering Bilderberg has been very assiduous. He's the premier writer on this subject, and there's only one person in the United States who has been consistently covering them for 25 years. Other AFP vets, like AFP editor emeritus Vince Ryan, praised Tucker for his tireless work over the years. Executive editor Chris Petherick explained how Tucker had his congressional credentials stripped after he lifted Senator Charles Mathias's top-secret portfolio at a Bilderberg conference. Petherick explained that, when he was editor, he had to go before a dozen hostile mainstream journalists to argue that Tucker should be given his credentials back. "I told them that Jim had his credentials taken for doing what they all should be doing," said Petherick. "They obviously didn't like us very much and didn't want us there, and surprise, surprise, we never got back those credentials." AFP production manager Paul Angel joked about his entire perspective on the world being changed after meeting staff from The Spotlight and Jim Tucker 17 years ago. "I got to know Jim over the past 17 years, said Angel, "and I have to say that he's right on the money on the issues, including globalization and the Bilderbergers. I thought he was crazy at first, but long ago I realized that he's not the one who is nuts. It's the mainstream media that covers for these criminals on a daily basis that is crazy, and a core part of the problem." AFP editor Mark Anderson followed with his descriptions of the 2010 Bilderberg conference, where he witnessed firsthand Tucker being swarmed like a celebrity with non-Bilderberg groupies. Anderson called Tucker the newsman's newsman while lamenting, "Throughout the world, foreign press agencies are covering Tucker's work, yet the American media continues to black him out." Anderson added, "What's great about Jim is that he's come from the old school and he's been able to make peace with the new school and all the new technology. I also came out of conventional news as well. Now it's mind-blowing to be here, especially working with Jim." After a top-notch buffet that was put together by event organizer Pete Papaheraklis, the most entertaining moments of this gala were provided by keynote speaker Pat Shannon, who played the role of Don Rickles, reeling off zingers, one-liners, and barbs that were directed not only at Tucker, but the entire AFP staff. Needless to say, the audience, some of whom traveled from New York City, Boston, Rhode Island, and Tennessee, ate it up as Shannon poked good-natured fun at the editors, reporters, and others. On a more serious note, Shannon later told this writer, "Jim Tucker's indefatigable chase of the Bilderberg elite has really been nothing more than the same endeavor all newspapers should be giving to it, but he's still the only one doing it." Then, Shannon invoked Teddy Roosevelt's famed speech at the Sorbonne in France on April 23, 1910, to highlight Tucker's career, to wit, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." "And so, Jim Tucker, you have been in the arena for a long time," said Shannon, "and we want to thank you for everything you've done." After all the hilarity and ribbing, Bilderberg's most reviled news hound stepped to the podium and rebutted all his previous roasters. Earlier in the day, Tucker sat down and answered some questions for AFP. As Piper correctly noted, Tucker is quite the raconteur, and the stories he tells are undoubtedly one of a kind. For instance, Tucker described once donning the uniform of a groundskeeper, complete with a rake, to get closer to his globalist foes, or how one year he grew a beard to better disguise himself. Tucker added with his dry sense of humor, "The only way they won't recognize me now is if I dress like a girl, and at my age I don't plan on doing that." Even better, at one Bilderberg conference, Tucker hired a driver, then near midnight scaled a fence and entered the heavily guarded hotel grounds. Shortly thereafter, Tucker heard gunfire and, as he tells it, ran like a scared rabbit back to my driver's waiting car. He was, however, sure to clarify that since the bullets sailed 20 feet above his head, they weren't intended to kill, only to scare him. Their tactic certainly worked. When asked which Bilderberger took the most dislike to him, Tucker quickly responded, "Henry Kissinger, because I exposed his German accent as nothing more than a phony affectation. He doesn't like being embarrassed." Finally, after being queried about the Bilderbergs' recent frustrations, especially in regard to their inability to establish an American union, Tucker stated with pride, "In their own words, these boys have expressed great anger over a expletive weekly newspaper in Washington, D.C., that has now forced other newspapers to at least acknowledge their annual meetings." Without Tucker's efforts, the world would be far more entrenched in the globalists' clutches, subjected to UN taxes and even more stringent media suppression. To summarize his father's role as the Bilderbergs' primary nemesis, Jim Tucker III remarked, "My father has been predicting the future for us, whether it be gas prices or war." Source reveals much about TC by James P. Tucker Jr. Members of the elite globalist group, the Trilateral Commission, TC, met in secret over the weekend of April 8th to 10th to discuss, among other things, ways to stifle growing nationalism in Europe and the United States, which has been throwing a wrench into the internationalist dream of world government. The TC is a private organization founded by David Rockefeller that claims to be promoting increased cooperation among the United States, Europe, and Japan. However, in reality, it is yet another little-known globalist group that operates in secret to undermine U.S. sovereignty and foster global government. After consulting with the Trilateral Commission, it might be passed, the Polish News Bulletin reported April 6th. The newspaper was referring to the nation's multi-year financial plan for the 2011 to 2014 period. They hope to have a draft budget within a month. The Polish People's Party had wanted to reduce the size of government and cut back on interdependence among nations. Trilateralists want Poland and all Europeans roped into the European Union as a superstate and the elimination of nationalist sentiment. So the trilateralists gathered Poland's Council of Ministers and ordered a macroeconomic budget. Their orders were followed. Poland has always been a trilateral Bilderberg problem. Poland was the first country in Eastern Europe to break away from the old Soviet Union, opening floodgates that tore down the Iron Curtain. But this incident again demonstrates the trilateralists' raw power. TC met in Washington April 8 to 10 at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, situated at 419 19th Street Northwest. But TC went to absurd lengths to hide. On the daily and weekly events listing, its name was absent. But subjects as relations with China, globalist zero in the American presidency, and oppression in Roma had a TC scent. An employee confirmed that TC was conducting these sessions. AFP's source provided inside information. Robert Zelek, president of the World Bank, said the bank should throw money into civil societies in Arab countries because the current wave of political unrest shows the limit of their economic development. Now it may be time to invest in the private, not-for-profit sector, civil society, to help strengthen the capacity of organizations working on transparency, accountability, and service delivery, Zelek told his fellow trilateralists. He said the World Bank used to overlook corruption when investing in developing, a euphemism for poor, countries. Stronger civil societies would act as a check on governments and lead to better economic results. I suggest that it is now time for the World Bank to examine whether the bank needs new capabilities or facilities to strengthen the capacity of civil society organizations working on accountability and transparency and service delivery, he said. Costs of such spending would be paid mostly by Americans. The United States pays 22% of World Bank costs, and the other 180-plus member nations pay the rest. Americans pay 27% of peacekeeping costs at 131 sites around the globe, but their own borders are unprotected. These funds go to finance the UN's World Army. Dr. Sah Kang II, chairman of the Korea International Trade Association and G20 Summit Korea Coordination Committee, attended the Trilateral Commission meeting, the Korea Herald reported. Sah Kang addressed global governance, the newspaper reported. They continued to grouse about the leak that alerted Americans to the fact that the rebel movement in Libya, which is supported by the United States and the UN, is not a popular uprising, but has been controlled by Western and Israeli forces. Using foul language, they denounced that bleep bleep newspaper for spilling our beans and forcing that stuff into the daily newspapers. This was an obvious reference to AFP, this reporter's source told him. TC, like its brother group, Bilderberg, wants the war in Libya to inflame the entire Middle East, so America will be further dragged into the Middle East. Eventually, they contend this will lead to a U.S. attack on Iran for Israel's sake. It also means big bucks for international financiers. Page 15, Eye on Israel. While World Watches Libya, Israel Gets Offensive, by Richard Walker. Israel has exploited the global fixation with the Libyan crisis to break a range of international laws while it secretly weighs the benefits of launching a second attack on Palestinians in Gaza or starting another war against Hezbollah in Lebanon. The laws Israel has broken range from the planned construction of hundreds more Jewish settler homes on Palestinian land to the launching of a missile attack inside the African country of Sudan. The Sudan attack, which killed two men in a car near Sudan's main port city, Port Sudan, was carried out using American-made Apache helicopters, which fired missiles that are typically used only by Israel. The Sudanese government said it was an infringement of its territorial integrity. Before the attack, Israel blocked radar Sudan uses to track civilian aircraft in its airspace. Some experts said the move could have led to a mid-air collision and exemplified Israel's cynical use of military power. It was the second time in 2 years the Israeli military carried out attacks within Sudan. In 2009, it used missiles to target a convoy of cars it claimed were part of an arms smuggling operation. Israel's intelligence agency Mossad has also been busy running one of its familiar kidnapping operations, this time abducting a Palestinian engineer, Dirar Abu Sisi, in Ukraine and secretly transporting him to Israel. Sisi was responsible for redesigning Gaza's only electrical power plant to run on diesel supplied by Egypt, making it less reliant on Israeli fuel supplies. His wife, who is Ukrainian, claims her husband was in her country applying for citizenship for him and his children because he thought Gaza was too dangerous for his family. On February 19, 2011, Sisi vanished after being taken from a train by two men claiming to be Ukrainian state security agents. The Ukrainian government denied involvement in his disappearance and referred the matter to the United Nations. On April 4, 2011, Sisi reappeared in a court in Israel, charged with being a Hamas rocket specialist. The Israelis alleged Hamas sent him to Ukraine to study Scud missile technology. The Palestinian Authority said his abduction was yet another class classic example of Israel committing international crimes. Meanwhile, Israel has launched missile attacks on Gaza that have killed Hamas members and injured scores of civilians, including children. The excessive use of Israeli firepower, allegedly a response to a recent Palestinian rocket attack that injured an Israeli boy, signaled a growing desire by the Israeli government to launch another Gaza attack. However, such a move would draw the ire of surrounding Arab states and condemnation by Turkey and EU nations. Turkey has made it clear to Washington it will, under no circumstances, normalize relations with Israel while it acts like a bloodthirsty bully. Were Israel to launch an Operation Cast-led II invasion of Gaza, Israeli officials contend they would likely face retaliation from Hezbollah in Lebanon. And with that in mind, there are signs Israel is preparing to start another war with Hezbollah, which beat back the Israeli military in 2006. In a move that smacks of Israel justifying military action before it begins, the Israeli military circulated a map it says shows 1,000 Hezbollah underground sites in Lebanon. It claims the sites are for weapon storage and forward targeting and are in 270 villages besides civilian facilities, including schools and hospitals. In other words, if Israel bombs the sites in the near future, causing massive civilian casualties, it will say it warned Hezbollah not to put the lives of ordinary Lebanese in harm's way by locating its facilities near civilian structures. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah has warned he will send forces into Israel if it attacks Lebanon. He also made it clear he possesses rockets capable of striking Tel Aviv. Page 16, AFP on scientific advances. Made-to-order human organs. Analysts say custom-grown hearts, etc., will be big business in the future. By Frank Whalen. Scientists are reporting that they are growing human hearts in laboratories, giving thought to the promise of made-to-order organs. Surprisingly, now that such creations are possible and actually taking place, the usual fears of Frankenstein-style science are not being heard. Such revelations took place at the American College of Cardiology's annual conference in New Orleans when Dr. Doris Taylor announced that human hearts were indeed growing and scientists were hopeful that they would begin beating in only weeks. The process involved taking hearts from human cadavers and stripping away cells and tissue until only the proteinaceous collagen structure remained. The ghost hearts were then injected with millions of stem cells from a patient. The cells identified the structure as cardiac tissue and began growing as heart muscle cells. As they continue to mature, scientists hope these hearts will beat properly and with enough strength to pump blood. According to an April 3rd edition of The Australian, these scientific teams have undertaken a similar experiment with animals. In that study, they had taken the ghost hearts of rats and pigs and seeded them with human stem cells. Again, the cells multiplied, colonized the structure, and started to beat independently. However, the beating strength was only 25% that of a normal heart, but the fact that the hearts were beating at all was seen as a triumph. While there are many hurdles along the way, hopes are that if such research proves viable, the lifetime prescription medications a typical transplant recipient has to endure would be eliminated. Also, possibilities of a body rejecting an organ made from its own stem cells would be less likely. At the moment, there are a few stirrings of discontent. International Business Times reported on April 4th, some were worried that unwarranted hype, both by the media and the scientific community, is undermining serious research. From artificial to animal organs, from blood transfusions to artificial insemination, from unethical scientific research and even era-approved techniques like eugenics, there have always been questions raised about the moral boundaries being pushed through innovation. There have as yet been few concerns raised about the ghost hearts being taken from dead bodies or the use of stem cells in the process. Perhaps this is due to potential elimination of the organ harvesting trade, whether being done by organized crime syndicates or even pressure being brought to bear by doctors anxious to get approval to acquire organs for transplantation. The ethics of this issue have frequently been weighed against the desire for survival. However, like the criminal side to the organ trade, the profitability of growing organs will most likely drive the research and fast-track the arrival of made-to-order organ replacements. Through the guise of funding humanitarian research, the possibility of wealthy recipients being able to replace worn body parts surely will allow this science to move forward. A potential world could exist where dictators achieve a much longer lifespan to control populations, and consequence-free lifestyles would be pushed to the limits if money were the only obstacle to virtual immortality. Such tales have already been told in Hollywood through films such as The Island, where the wealthy have clones grown for spare body parts. In Repo Men, a megacorporation repossesses artificial organs from recipients who can't afford their payments. Speaking on the morality of using artificial wombs, syndicated columnist Dr. Charles Krauthammer was quoted by The New Atlantist as saying at an October 2003 meeting of the President's Council on Bioethics, "Once you put an embryo in an animal, which is a thing for these purposes, or a machine, which might happen in the future, you create a completely atomized and defenseless creature, and that opens the way to all kinds of tyrannies, social control, and lack of autonomy, which we would not want." The prospect of custom-ordered organs could be the beginning of a mainstream acceptance of human-driven innovation to design either the perfect body or perhaps the darker route of engineering the perfect slave. Page 17, AFP Consumer Alert. Air Travel Alert by Keith Hansen. Even though Southwest Airlines has a sound safety record and its preferred aircraft, the Boeing 737, is a dependable workhorse, the recent discovery of cracks in five of the fleet's planes didn't come as a surprise to industry insiders. The issue of whether structural stress of aircraft is accelerated because of so-called short-haul duty has been moved front and center in the news ever since an April 1st incident in which a five-foot section of Southwest Flight 812's fuselage was peeled back along the top of the 737-300 jet. The rupture immediately depressurized the cabin, forcing crew members to nose the plane into a controlled dive of 20,000 feet in less than 5 minutes. The jetliner en route from Phoenix to Sacramento sustained no further damage and made an emergency landing at a military base in Yuma, Arizona, with no injuries to the 115 aboard. This plane had already logged 39,000 pressurization cycles, each representing one takeoff and landing, which translates into 7.2 cycles per day for the 15 years it has been in service. According to a Southwest fact sheet, the average trip length is 648 miles, with the average duration being under 2 hours. Those numbers give Southwest one of the highest utilization rates in the industry. On average, Southwest's planes are 11.2 years old and fly 6 trips per day. Two pilots, each of whom flies for a major commercial carrier with hubs in the East, spoke to AFP about Southwest on condition of anonymity. One pilot said, "They do a good job, but in the back of my mind, I wondered when that kind of flying would take a toll on their fleet." The other pilot said, "They do things a little different than everybody else, which in some cases I consider dangerous. There is a pay incentive for them to fly as fast as they can. In my mind, that's necessarily going to stress the airplanes even more over the long haul." Page 18, The Dark Side with Victor Thorne. What will Trump find in Obama's past? By Victor Thorne. Amid the hoopla, showboating, and innuendo surrounding billionaire Donald Trump's recent media blitz where he's been questioning the validity of Barack Obama's birth certificate, the New York real estate tycoon made an amazing, insightful comment. "There's something on that birth certificate President Obama doesn't want people to see," Trump declared with bravado during a successive three-night appearance with Fox News commentator Bill O'Reilly. On April 7th, Trump sat down with NBC Morning Show host Meredith Vieira to further elaborate on his suspicions. "I'm not convinced that he, Obama, has a birth certificate," said Trump. "His grandmother in Kenya said he was born in Kenya and she was there and witnessed the birth. He doesn't have a birth certificate or he hasn't shown it. He has what's called a certificate of live birth, issued 8 days after the birth. It's not the equivalent of a birth certificate because it doesn't have a serial number or even a signature by anybody." Trump continued, "Obama has spent $2 million in legal fees trying to get away from this issue. If he wasn't lying, why doesn't he just solve it and show his birth certificate? If he doesn't, it's one of the greatest scams in the history of politics." The high-profile entrepreneur next commented on sending two investigators to Hawaii. "I have people who are studying it," he said, "and they're not believing what they're finding." To prove his tenacity, on April 8th in Manhattan, Trump met with Representative Carl Seal, Republican Arizona, who is backing HB 2177 that is currently moving through Arizona's legislature. The Arizona bill would require every presidential candidate to present a certified birth certificate before his name could appear on any ballot. Although speculation has centered on whether Obama was born in Hawaii or Kenya, the real heart of this matter lies not where he was delivered, but rather the identity of his actual father. As this author's book, Frontman, Obama's Darkest Secrets Revealed, carefully details, the best evidence points to a communist poet named Frank Marshall Davis as the man who got Obama's mother, the 18-year-old Stanley Ann Dunham, pregnant. During an April 5th interview, this writer asked radio show host Mike Rivero about his recent posting writings on the subject. Rivero explained, Obama wants to keep his birth certificate hidden because the name of his father is different than Barack Hussein Obama Sr. My theory is the original birth certificate lists Frank Marshall Davis as his father. As Obama's handlers began grooming him for political office decades ago, they realized that their candidate being an illegitimate child was the least of their concerns. However, they could never allow the public to discover that Davis was an avowed communist investigated by the FBI, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the Commission on Subversive Activities. Further, Davis penned an autobiographical pornography book entitled Sex Rebel, Memoirs of a Gash Gourmet, where he recounts episodes of pedophilia, homosexual encounters, and a variety of other acts unprintable in this newspaper. Davis referred to his authorship of Sex Rebel in the following terms. All incidents I have described have been taken from actual experiences. After boasting of his preoccupation with bedding white women, Davis tells of a sexual encounter with an underaged girl named Anne. Obama's mother, Stanley Ann, moved with her family to Hawaii in the summer of 1960 after graduating from high school. Since Barack Obama was born on August 4, 1961, his mother would have conceived in November 1960, which fits into the Hawaiian timeline. High school classmate Susan Blake described Stanley Ann, a provocative teen reared by unconventional parents, as a girl who never dated crew-cut white boys. Obama himself confirmed her predilections in his autobiography, where he noted the discomfort he experienced whenever his mother talked about black men. The possibility that Davis and Stanley Ann met gained significant credibility when, on October 21, 2008, genealogical researcher Paul Bearden discovered nude photographs taken of Obama's mother. In Bearden's original October 2008 emails obtained by this writer from Dr. John Ray, Bearden conjectures that the photos were taken in Hawaii by a mature man who knows what he likes, including young girls. Some people, however, claim the photos are not of Obama's mother, but are instead of a model, Marcy Moore. Others say Moore's resemblance to Miss Dunham is striking, but clearly it is not Moore in the photos. Additionally, Davis moved with his white wife to Hawaii in 1948. At his previous residence in Chicago, he was the founder of a photography club. Davis was originally born in Kansas, as were Stanley Ann's parents, who also had affiliations with the American Communist Party. In Hawaii, Davis and the Dunhams developed a close relationship. Gerald Horn, a University of Houston history professor who also contributed to a Communist Party journal, said that Davis came into contact with Barack Obama and his family and became the young man's mentor. In his autobiography, Dreams from My Father, Obama identified his childhood mentor as a man named Frank. A close friend, Donna Weatherly Williams, confirmed that Davis knew Stan, Obama's grandfather, real well, even acknowledging that they smoked marijuana together. Research also shows that Mrs. Dunham let her husband carouse with Davis. By all accounts, she said, after Obama's mother abandoned him to live with his grandparents, the Dunhams in Hawaii in 1970, Obama and Frank Marshall Davis developed what was characterized as a father-son relationship. What are we to make of Stanley Ann Dunham's alleged marriage to the Kenyan Barack Obama Sr.? In an August 16, 2009 article entitled Obama Mama, Six Lost Months, Jerome Corsi pointed out four glaring inconsistencies to their questionable wedding. 1. No photographs of Dunham's wedding to Barack Obama Sr. have ever been published. 2. No marriage certificate for the couple has ever been found or published. 3. No photographs have yet surfaced of the parents with Barack Obama Jr. at the hospital where he was born. And 4. No photographs have yet surfaced of the parents after the newly born infant was taken home. In Dreams from My Father, Obama wrote of his parents' supposed betrothal. There's no record of a real wedding, a cake, a ring, a giving away of the bride. No families were in attendance. The whole thing seems so fragile in retrospect, so haphazard. It almost seems as if the entire affair was erratically thrown together in order to cover up a scandal or to hide somebody's identity. Frank Marshall Davis was already married to another white woman at the time. As a 10-year-old boy discarded by his mother and taken under the wing of the much older Frank Marshall Davis, a self-admitted pedophile and a drug-using deviant, it is this writer's contention that Barack Obama may have in fact been sexually abused by Davis, the same man who impregnated his teenage mother during one of his many conquests. Obama himself described in Dreams from My Father how, as a youth, he would drink whiskey with Davis and then engage in composing dirty limericks. Limericks. Also, as a coming-of-age exhibition of Obama's talent that he learned from Davis, Obama, at the time a 19-year-old freshman at Occidental College, had a poem called Pop, published in a student journal. A close reading of this poem indicates that it is in reference to Davis and contains allusions to pedophilia. Even stranger, Larry Sinclair has related on numerous occasions, even at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., his homosexual encounters with Obama on November 6th and 7th, 1999. In two different interviews with this writer, Sinclair described in detail the circumstances and specific events surrounding these trysts. Sinclair eventually authored a book entitled Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder. In this tell-all, he provides scores of scintillating details, again, many of which are not printable in this newspaper. Hidden from inspection are Obama's birth certificate, college transcripts, work history, his CIA affiliation, mysterious overseas travel records, conflicting Social Security numbers, faked years at Columbia University, and friendships with some of Chicago's seediest political mobsters. Practically his entire life is a lie concealed by smoke and mirrors. Worse, every person from his past who could reveal his secrets is dead, including his grandfather, 1992, mother, 1995, alleged Kenyan father, 1982, and Frank Marshall Davis, 1987. Even Obama's Hawaiian grandmother died one day before the 2008 presidential election. Journalist Mike Rivero provides further anecdotal evidence of another slip Obama made where he mentioned during a June 28, 2008 speech to the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials that his father served in World War II. Rivero notes, however, Obama Sr. and later Sotiro, his mother's second husband, were too young to serve in World War II. The far older Davis did in fact serve in World War II. Frontman, Obama's Darkest Secrets Revealed by Victor Thorne. Soft cover, 112 pages. $20 plus $3 shipping and handling. Call 1-888-699-NEWS toll free to charge to a major credit card or send payment to American Free Press, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Page 21, AFP on Corporate Crime. Internet Giants Book Theft Exposed by Watchdog Group by Mark Anderson. In H.G. Wells' novel, The Time Machine, the scientist who rides his time travel machine far into a dystopian future finds himself among a docile, childlike, post-human race called the Alloy. There's another one called the Morlocks. The Alloy show the English inventor the rings of knowledge. The rings speak when placed on a table in a manner that makes them vibrate. The inventor hears, if you will, a record of all the world's knowledge. What few actual books remain crumble to dust in his hands. Well, critics of the internet search giant Google, which AFP has scrutinized along with other big players in the information surveillance state matrix, say the California-based company with tentacles reaching around the globe seems bent on becoming the keeper of all knowledge and not necessarily with benign intentions. Mindful of Google's tendencies, critics are hailing a decision March 22nd by U.S. District Court Judge Denny Chin in New York, who ruled against Google's attempt to digitally copy millions of books without the permission of authors or publishing houses. One company should not have control over the body of world literature. This victory, hopefully, is the beginning of more scrutiny over Google's business practices and use of its monopolistic position online, Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog, CW, said in a prepared statement. It's not every day you beat one of America's biggest companies in court. A federal judge agreed with Consumer Watchdog's strong antitrust arguments and prevented Google from gaining a monopoly over digitized online books. CW's court added, Consumer Watchdog was the first one to call for the U.S. Justice Department to block the Google Books deal, where Google scanned most of the books in the world without asking for permission from the authors. A digital books library should be available only with the consent of all authors. A more recent Consumer Watchdog bulletin posted on the California-based organization's website added, Judge Chin ruled that the agreement would grant Google significant rights to exploit entire books without the permission of copyright owners and would give Google a significant advantage over competitors, rewarding it for engaging in wholesale copying of copyrighted works without permission while releasing claims well beyond the case. Google's entire business model is to never ask permission but to seek forgiveness if necessary. John M. Simpson, director of CW's Privacy Project, was quoted as saying on his organization's website. Judge Chin has ruled simply that you can't take other people's property and use it without asking. This should send the message to the engineers at the Googleplex that the next time they want to use someone's intellectual property, they need to ask permission. As Google continues mapping the Earth, collecting pictures of everyone's property, and overlapping its functions with intelligence agencies, in a digitized culture where there are few limits on what corporations can do, perhaps this ruling can start a sorely needed antitrust trend to also include the financial giants foreclosing on Americans' homes and individual freedom. But total victory can be elusive. Simpson, while walking a California beach the afternoon of April 5th, told AFP by phone, "In fact, Google is still scanning books, and that this six-year-old lawsuit may not be totally over, since Google maintains that posting snippets of books online is fair use." Simpson added, "They've got deep pockets." He recalled that the suit, which started in 2005, evolved into a class action lawsuit after the initial filing by plaintiffs that included the American Publishers Association, a National Authors Guild, and a number of individual authors. Consumer Watchdog filed two amicus briefs to try to bust the trust Google represents. RTT News, an online source, added that back in 2005, the plaintiffs subjected to Google's mass digitization of millions of books on copyright violation grounds. Google began scanning books in 2004. Page 22, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. Justice, new evidence was forged in Demania case by James P. Trafficant. A so-called secret FBI report held undisclosed for 2.5 decades could have once saved a man's apparent execution and now may possibly finalize the ugly ordeal of a former Cleveland, Ohio auto worker. That man is John Demjanjuk. The hidden FBI report says that the former Soviet Union quite likely fabricated key evidence central to the prosecution of Demjanjuk, who the Justice Department claimed was the infamous guard Ivan the Terrible of the Treblinka camp in Poland. The evidence of importance was a National Socialist ID card that placed Demjanjuk as a guard at the Sobibor camp in Poland. The ID card was from the Nazis' Tronica training camp, where prisoners were trained to guard less fortunate prisoners in Nazi concentration camps. The Justice Department has claimed for all these years that this key ID card is authentic and proves beyond any doubt that Demjanjuk is guilty of war crimes. The Office of Special Investigations, OSI, is the Nazi hunting agency of the Justice Department. This group of so-called champions of millions of victims should have been imprisoned for their actions against Demjanjuk in the past. I was the congressman who helped prove Demjanjuk's innocence in his first ordeal. Demjanjuk was stripped of his citizenship and shipped to Israel to stand trial, where he was found guilty of mass murders as the infamous Ivan and sentenced to death. When I got involved, Demjanjuk was on death row, awaiting execution. I was ostracized in the mainstream media and labeled an anti-Semite for even talking to the family. The Demjanjuk family visited every member of both the House and the Senate to no avail. No one would even meet with them. The case was too sensitive. As our investigation proceeded, it was evident the OSI had broken every law known to civilized man to gain a wrongful conviction against Demjanjuk. The OSI suborned the perjury of one Otto Horn, a former Nazi SS officer. Horn testified at trial that he had assisted Ivan at the gas chambers. Documents ultimately came into our possession that proved conclusively that Horn perjured himself at trial with the full cognizance of OSI, which had orchestrated the lie. Later documents proved the true identity of Ivan the Terrible as one Ivan Marchenko. I had attained this evidence with a Freedom of Information FOIA request, since all the files on Demjanjuk were hidden under the cloak of classified. The amazing factor was that all this evidence actually came from the Justice Department. They knew all along that Demjanjuk was not Ivan, yet they persecuted this man and cared less that he would be put to death. Prosecutor Moskovitz should have been sent to prison for life for his willful behavior to destroy this man's life, not to mention the trauma and pain levied against his family. But who cared? Well, I cared. I say it then and I say it now. When you violate the right of one American, you endanger and threaten the rights of all Americans. So now, after 25 years, a hidden FBI report has surfaced showing that even the FBI knew the Tronica ID card was, quite frankly, fabricated. What puzzles me is that the FBI did nothing about it. They allowed Moskovitz to suborn perjury, rape Demjanjuk's civil rights, obstruct justice, and ultimately permit the government to allow this man to be put to death. Shame. And shame on us, all Americans, who discovered these facts, yet did not force the prosecution of Moskovitz or anyone in the OSI or Justice Department for these most heinous crimes. I brought Demjanjuk home from Israel after the Israeli Supreme Court let him go on the strength of our evidence. When we landed in New York, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, Ohio, released the following statement. It was a tragic but honest mistake by our government. Unbelievable. The court exonerated Moskovitz and all the other lowlifes with but a simple statement. A tragic but honest mistake. How did they decide that this crime was nothing but a mistake? This is the same court who would not accept our evidence. No congressional committee would even hold a hearing on this. They said the case was too sensitive. Since when does sensitivity waive the Bill of Rights? Maybe now Demjanjuk will be finally freed. His new trial in Germany is nearing conclusion. Hopefully, Demjanjuk will be treated fairly. The lowlifes should not pass go, but be sent directly to jail. Get back at me. Editorial. Obama's right. Time for plutocrats to pay their share. American Free Press has never pulled any punches when it comes to Barack Obama. We have published news stories about Obama and some of the dark shadows that haunt him personally and politically that no other American newspaper has ever dared to publish. But unlike the partisan press, which alternately loves Obama, screaming liberal Democratic rhetoric in his favor, or hates him, shrieking conservative Republican bombast against him, AFP is able to look at Obama objectively and without being ideologically hidebound to automatically support him or oppose him as a course of a programmatic knee-jerk agenda. When Obama has done something that AFP agrees with, we haven't had any problem saying something nice about him, even though when we do, a lot of our readers get angry. Likewise, when he veers in the wrong direction, AFP isn't afraid to tell the truth and expose the misdeeds. As the old saying goes, the truth hurts. And now comes AFP to assert that Obama's recent speech on reducing the debt made a lot of sense in many ways. And that's a fact that is going to rile many people who are conditioned to see Obama, shall we say it, in black and white terms. AFP opposes socialism and is firmly in favor of free enterprise. But a lot of people confuse the concepts of socialism and capitalism and view them as opposites. In fact, capitalism, in its purest, untrammeled sense, is just as pernicious and monopolistic as socialism and, in that sense, is really the other side of the socialist coin. It's no accident that big money interests, that is, the capitalists, have historically been on the side of big government, and of course, so have the socialists. So the point is that when President Obama talked about the need to put some brakes on big money and his critics had said he wants to do, soak the rich, the truth is that AFP finds it hard to disagree. The hard-working middle-class people of America have always been the ones to bear the brunt of the archaic, immoral, outmoded, Marxist-inspired, progressive income tax, which is really anything but that. Ultimately, the really rich, the plutocratic intriguers of Wall Street and the international corporate wheeler-dealers, don't pay taxes at the rates of regular folks, and that even includes people and corporations in the 11-figure range. The tax system is broke. It's morally bankrupt. It needs reform. And Obama, and the Republicans, too, those same GOP types that always get blue in the face when someone dares to say boo to Wall Street, can make some real change by doing something decisive about it. But in the meantime, AFP thinks the big money boy should start paying the bills that keep this country running and giving middle-class taxpayers a break. Soak the rich? Sounds like a pretty good idea to us.